Shalom. Thank you for joining me this week. This week we're going to take a look at Parshat Baha'alotcha, which deals with a variety of different issues, but we're going to specifically focus on the problem with the riffraff and how some things tend to stop us and other things tend to set us free. I thank you so much for joining me. Please take a moment when you have a chance and drop me an email or call me on my Skype line, 610-624-3441. I'd love to hear from you. Again, shalom, and thank you for listening. Our Torah portion this week continues the story of going through the desert. First, the Israelites receive instruction on how to make the lampstand for the tabernacle. It is to be hammered in a certain way, and this pattern was reportedly shown to Moses by God. The rest of the parasha delves into issues about cleansing the Levites and who can serve in the tent of meeting, and rules about coming in contact with a dead body. In an interesting digression, the Torah mentions the non-Jews who made their homes in the Israelite camp and addresses the issue of how they might participate in the Passover sacrifice. The rule was that the standards for the non-Jew were to be the same as the Jew, and that there should be only one way of carrying out a Passover sacrifice for the entire community. Mustering the troops and how various camps should be arrayed around the tabernacle is also addressed. A passage that is included in the traditional Torah service is found in the 10th chapter, which has, to my knowledge, the only brackets in the entire Torah. Contained in these brackets, which actually are inverted nuns, were the words that meant that the community was to move forward or was to cease movement. Lest we think everything was nice and orderly, chaos did break forth this week as the Israelites were invaded by the riffraff. Not that Israelites would ever complain. Anyway, the riffraff started a problem about the food. It seems that when the Israelite community is finally ready to move forward, it stops, or should I say, dysfunctions. Everything is set up in an orderly fashion, as if God herself was placing the various components together so the Israelites could march together to the Promised Land. Alas, a revolt breaks out, first driven by a strange fire, and then the people need to complain again about the food. God is so angry that if God had a nose, the text tells us that it turned red. Then God proceeded to give the people something other than manna. God gave them quail. According to one source, there was so much quail that everyone had collected about 10 homers of quail. No, this is not The Simpsons, but it is spelled the same way. And these 10 homers of quail roughly equals about 220 kilograms of quail. Now, those of you who have been to Israel and wandered in the desert of Sinai probably understand the problem with 600,000 Israelites having about 500 pounds, everybody had 500 pounds of quail, in the middle of a hot, very hot desert with no refrigeration. Let's just say that homonyms work for a reason, like the homonyms of foul and fowl, which in Middle English, before the year 900, were spelled the same. But were things so foul? The Israelites had a pretty good run with God until this point. In fact, almost everything God said would happen had occurred. Egypt, leaving, plagues, Sinai, purpose, Promised Land. All these things would have told most people that God's plan and Moses' leadership were doing quite well. Why then the problem? One of the issues that people often face is that they get so prepared for a moment, and then when they arrive or achieve the day before, they are less than prepared for the emotional place that they need to be in at that moment. Think of the first time jitters or butterflies you have had at some point in the past. Did you really know less than what you needed to regarding the technical aspects or proficiency? I share with you that as a rabbi, my Hebrew was probably never as good on a technical level as when I left rabbi school 13 years ago this week. But something is different. Over the past 13 years, I've learned what being on a bima means. I've learned what counseling sessions are all about or how to move one way or another in a meeting. The technical aspects of my Hebrew proficiency have given way to larger questions like, what does it all mean? I can still parse most verbs and tell you the grammar of a sentence, but I have to tell you something. Those aren't relevant questions in the pulpit. At least they're not relevant questions on a daily, weekly, or even monthly basis. In rabbi school, they were absolutely important, and I have had an occasion to use Hebrew since, but the big questions of life, meaning, purpose, finding a sense of peace, these aren't things that can be trained or learned through the power of intellect. Intellect must find a bridge to the emotional to discover these, and that bridge is very narrow, to borrow a phrase from Reb Nachman of Bratslav. So when I read through this Torah portion, I now understand that technically the Israelites might have been ready. The scene is set, ark, warriors, military formations. But the fact that the riffraff, this handful of naysayers, has the ability to cause enough problems to result in not one, but two plagues? This is a cautionary tale to us. That regardless of the amount of preparation that goes into any of our efforts, it takes the wrong people, and very few wrong people, at the wrong time, to pull hard work and serious dedication back into the chaos. The reality in the Torah, and even today, is that we can never go back. We can only go forward. The Israelites faced this problem when they sought to go back to Egypt, back to the narrow places, because the food was better. Perhaps the food was better, but the price they had to pay was way too high. That food came at the cost of throwing their male children to drown or be eaten by crocodiles in the Nile. Perhaps the food was better, but no one could call it free. Rather, it demanded some of the highest prices one could ever be required to pay in the form of causing the Israelites to forsake their future. Perhaps this is why God becomes so angry. Not because of wanting Israelites, but because what they really were asking for was to return to a place where they had to sacrifice half of their children for their own comfort and privilege. Yes, there are prices that are too high, then and now. Our challenge in this generation is beginning to build what could be the most meaningful Jewish community the world has ever known. Not because we have the Torah scholars or of the past, or because there's a return to the shtetl, or Balak Kinwood for that matter, which is where I live, but because our Judaism focuses on the meaningful responses we have learned from our texts and histories, and we choose, we decide, we reach into the Torah and bring a mitzvah into the world today as a conscious act. Regardless of the greatness of a Torah scholar, there has to be a vibrant, dedicated, and meaningful community to expand the Torah that people experience in their lives. And this takes us back to our Torah portion. Clearly, when it came to the non-Jew and the Passover Seder, there was one standard for the entire Jewish community. They knew then, as we do now, that without a norm for the Israelite community, without some common practice or text, they would lose their sense of identity, and thus also lose sense or connection to authenticity. A few weeks ago, Rabbi Lev Ba'esh stood on this bima and spoke of the challenges made by the wider community on the Jewish community. Challenges like answering the question, why is Israel important? And what do Jews believe? We are at a crossroads in the Jewish world because soon, very soon, most Jews will stop counting their generations in this country on one hand and will begin to move into using that second hand. This means that continuing Judaism has to be more than remembering the old country because, for the new generations, the old country isn't Poland. It's New York, the Lower East Side, if they remember that at all, or possibly even the suburbs of New Jersey. They don't get the feeling in their kishkas when they go to these places, because they have little more than stories of memories of these places. The fact is that in the next 20 years, we will determine how our congregations in Judaism embraces and captures the hearts of our young people and brings them to a Jewish dedication. They, like the Israelites in the desert, and we, who are also like those Israelites in the desert, may line up and have ourselves prepared with the correct formations, but when we begin to go forward, we have to make sure that the riffraff doesn't have the same kind of power it did in our Torah portion. For that band of individuals took great plans, much work, and transformed it into something totally worthless. We have to be in the mindset of creating a synagogue and community that doesn't render things worthless, but rather adds to their worth, meaning an ability to have a value that is enduring. Otherwise, like the Israelites in this Torah portion, we'll be left wondering what might have been for 40 more years until someone comes along who does believe in themselves, their community, and their Jewish future. What does this all mean to you? My prayer for you this week is that you're able to determine who the riffraff is in your life and ignore them, the naysayers, the ones who dwell on the what-ifs. My hope for you this week is that you will have the courage to conquer your fears and not give your fears the ability to conquer you. And may you surround yourself with the right people, with the right plans, and find and discover the things that are meaningful to you, and strive with all your effort to make them come true in your world. I wish you a wonderful week, and shalom.
Music you hear on this podcast can be ordered either by a download 24/7 or CD from the good folks at magnatune.com.